This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 17th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 62nd edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. What's happening today? We're getting closer to Christmas, but we're not quite flashing our cultural baubles at you quite yet. Maybe next show. Today's programme is a nice mix of this. Our New York editor hopped the plane due south to Miami to meet the galleries, collectors and party people at the premier American art fair, Art Basel, Miami Beach.
It's become better and better every year, and it's become a real must to be here. It's packed with international collectors coming from all over the world.
I take tea with Brazil's newly appointed culture minister, Marta Suplicy, who has an eye on how to sneak in some of the cream of Brazilian culture into the World Cup and Olympic marquee.
We are such a diversity and such a musical people and creative and in all kinds of arts that people are really amazed when they see everything. The way Brazilians are.
Emma Nelson gets sort of seasonal with a trip to the house of Charles Dickens, plus a session from Turkish jazz star Ilhan Ersehin. We meet the curator of the culturally switched-on Drake Hotel in Toronto and assess the 30th anniversary of the Alonzo King Ballet in San Francisco. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. But first, it's music time, of course, and we've got a mouth-watering, ear-humouring live Midori House session for you, as so often we have this year. This week, our studios played host to the enfant terrible of Turkish jazz, Ilhan Ersehin. Enfant terrible, enfant bon, more like. Here he is with 1-0. And that was Ilhan Ersehin with 1-0 from his Istanbul Sessions album, performing for us live here at Midori House. And you can hear more from him later on in the show. In a moment, we'll learn about some of the artful plans of Brazil's culture minister. But first, some sun. We're heading to Miami. 2 weeks ago, artists, collectors, gallerists, celebrities and people simply in search of a good party headed to the sunshine of Miami Beach for the city's 12th annual Art Basel. While officially centred at the Cavernous Convention Centre, where over 260 galleries displayed their wares, much of the week's business takes place in the hotels and nightclubs that line Collins Avenue. And New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears did a little exploring.
For 1 week every December, Miami Beach is transformed from a glitzy holiday town into the centre of the global contemporary art market. Now in its 12th year, Art Basel Miami Beach attracts not only collectors, artists and gallerists, but also huge crowds simply in search of a good party. Perfectly positioned to capitalise on the booming Latin American market, the art business does well in Miami Beach. And with plenty of sunshine, parties hosted by luxury brands like Chanel and Moncler, and pop-ups from some of the best nightclubs around the world, Miami attracts a younger audience than many other art fairs. Few people know the contemporary art market better than Simon Dupuy, the chairman of auction house Phillips Dupuy. I caught up with him to find out why he comes to Miami Beach.
It's become better and better every year, and it's become a real must to be here. It's packed with international collectors coming from all over the world. Of course, the Latin American input is much stronger in this fair than any other fair, given Miami's privileged position in that respect. And I am Swiss, and I was born in Basel originally, and so I've visited every Basel Art Fair since the very first one. And next year, I look forward to seeing the first Art Basel in Hong Kong. And it is to be expected that Art Basel will have the main art fair in Europe, main art fair in America, and could, with Art Basel Hong Kong, have the main art fair in Asia as well.
And you mentioned here, I mean, obviously we talk about this a lot when it comes to Miami, the importance of the Latin American market, but are you seeing a difference in the American market as well, in the North American market? Are people becoming more mature about how they buy art and where they go because they've got such a great fair on their own soil?
You have as many different motivations for collecting than you have different collectors. And so you have, of course, all the true collectors that are always on the lookout for new exciting things. Miami has attracted people who just want to have a great time and take advantage of being here during that week. Basel in Switzerland in June is much more just business for business, whereas here you have the vicinity of the beach, you have everything in walking distance, and there are so many events surrounding the art fair that you have an embarrassment of riches. You don't know which ones to go to, which ones to choose.
While many people in Miami are in a position to buy up the art on offer, others are in town for the experience. Morgan's Hotel Group is responsible for three of the most important and famous hotels in town, the Delano, the Shore Club, and the Mondrian. Alongside hosting regular events and parties, the Morgan's team this year commissioned a public art project called Plain Text, asking artists like Richard Prince, John Baldessari, and Jenny Holzer to submit phrases that were made into banners and flown across the Miami skyline. Kim Walker, Senior Vice President of Morgan's, and Adam Shopcorn, the curator behind Plain Text, told me a little more.
I'm always looking for projects to do for Morgan's, and I think Plain Text came out of, it was a nostalgic project for me, just a project where when I was younger and I would be at the beach and I would watch like planes fly banners by, I thought it would be nice to invite, 15 artists to create their own slogans for this project. And we have the planes, flying all over Miami, and Morgan's was very supportive. And I think it's important for Morgan's to be associated with the artists that are participating in the project, because, I was very lucky to get, the roster of artists that we got. And a lot of the artists are down here and they're staying with Morgan's.
I think that for us it was important to have our guests experience it, and also the city of Miami to give back something to them. They've been such great partners to us as a hotel company from the beginning when Art Basel first came in 2002. Ian Schrager, our founder, had gotten involved and really participated and really got behind the project to make sure that it was a success here. So I think for us, it was really just giving back to the city and just having everyone experience a great art project that Adam put together.
One of the clubs that opened for the first time for Miami Beach Art Basel this year was Silencio, the Parisian members club, which merges nightlife with regular exhibitions, performances and talks, a cultural mix which is perfect for Miami. Arno Frisch and Coralie Gauthier from Silencio explain how the temporary Miami edition of their club came about.
The club in Paris is aimed to gather different creative communities, especially international people. So we're really interested to be in major international events when we can gather members and non-members in different events that we organize. So we started with Cannes Film Festival last May, and we did another one for Serpentine in London in September. Yeah, we really wanted to do something like current with the place we're going to. So we worked with chef like Jacques Porcel in Cannes, and now we're doing Puff Daddy in Miami.
We are adapting to the country where we are going.
Yeah.
We are adapting. We are just like...
Yeah.
And I think it's really what Arnaud was saying earlier. It's like Silencio. It's a spirit that is gathering lots of different creative communities, and there is no specific, you know, tone. The only common point is, you know, to be creative, basically, to be from fashion, music, design, architecture. And that's true. It's really funny to start with the Chalet of Society, that is a new concept, you know, of itinerary museum, and then to have the Kills, that is a cool group, you know, like for a few years now. Tomorrow to go to tonight to go to Didi, that is like, you know, the really cliche of Miami in a way. And then the day after we are going to MoMA PS1, so it's like very institutional again. And then we're having our closing party.
While a good percentage of visitors to Miami Beach for Art Basel might be spending their days soaking up some sun on the beach rather than traipsing around an art fair, Miami is an important part of the contemporary art market's future. While museums around the world are struggling to attract young donors and collectors passionate about art, Art Basel in Miami clearly makes young people want to be part of the art world. And that's something which the global art market will be thankful for in years to come. For Monocle in Miami Beach, I'm Aisha Spears.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Right ho, we're off to speak to the newly appointed Brazilian Culture Minister now, and Culture Minister of Brazil is no small role. Marta Suplicy was the mayor of São Paulo, so knows how to corral a seemingly endless city into some sort of shape. But can she do the same with the arts in her huge, diverse country? I caught up with Minister Suplicy at the Brazilian Embassy in London to see what she's learned from watching the London Olympics and how she's going to try and slip some paintings and performers in with all that sport that will be happening over the next 4 years.
People want a partnership. I was not thinking about that in that level of things that they are interested in doing in Brazil. Long term, putting a lot of resources and really make it happen, and really make England go to Brazil. And that was a big surprise, a good surprise. And I'm going to work on that. I just had a meeting with Ruth McKenzie, who was the director of Cultural Olympia. And she was saying that Brazil was part of the success here because of the partnership that Brazil gave. It was the most willing country to work with. And
you had, I think, 40 artists coming over as part of the Cultural Olympiad in London, doing a lot of sort of artistic interventions in London during the Olympics, right? This was something that I saw and was quite a cool thing to see. Is that the sort of thing that kind of produces a bit of goodwill, a little bit of kind of guerrilla art action?
That too. I think because of other things made Brazil an important and nice country to people. Because of Lula, our last president, because of our dimension, our people, our creative cultural scene, that makes Brazil special. But what you are talking made a difference too. Always affects people to see Brazilian art. It's very different. We are such a diversity and such a musical people and creative and in all kinds of arts, that people are really amazed with when they see the way Brazilians are, very open. And this visit here was important for me because I had this good talk with the director of the Olympiad and could see and invite them to think if they are interested in having something going on the World Cup, a show of English art, a show of English culture. I don't know what can that be, but they are going to figure out. And I think that's important because you were the last one to have this big event. And we talk a lot about things that work out, like the, I don't know if I can say the name, Flash Mob, something like that.
Flash Mob, yeah.
Yeah, I never heard about that. I thought that was wonderful.
And presumably, there are a number of stereotypes that people have about Brazil that culture can counteract. You know, culture can stop people just purely thinking about football. I guess there is obviously a lot of cultural armory in Brazil. What are some of the things that you want to see on television screens around the world that, you know, examples of Brazilian culture?
You know, there are people who only think about football. It's okay. They're good for football.
But it needs a soundtrack as well, right?
Yeah, they'll go for football, it's all right. But some of them bring families that are not so keen on football. And even them, if they go to, they decide to go to a soccer game so far away as Brazil, it's because Brazil has an appeal. So I think it's different what happens in Brazil. People, I have heard a lot, people saying that I'm going because it's in Brazil. I want to get to know this country. So it's our time, it's our time, our moment. And I really want to, people to get to know our visual arts, our culture, all the diversity, because people know a lot of about our music. I'm even thinking about showing movies and have the legends for the Brazilian movies. We have very good movies. And to have a presentation of movies in theaters and different things. Theater, even people cannot understand. Sometimes they can see how good an actor is. How many times Brazilians see a Shakespeare play and don't understand a bit of English and they love it. So we are going to have many, many things that foreigners are not used to, mainly our primitive culture, like not only from Indians, that to have beautiful pottery and things like that, but also art from primitive art, pottery, also many in pottery too, that is made in Brazil and people don't know.
There's the São Paulo Biennale and the Rio Art Fair, which were earlier this year. These seem to be things that are growing of importance, you know, all over the world. Every single country in the world seems to have a Biennale. It's a great way of sort of flying the flag for everywhere. Is sort of contemporary art and selling art and exporting art, is that part of something that that these big sporting events can kind of give you a bit of energy for the art scene as well?
Sure, they can. But it's a bit sophisticated, I think, for World Cup at the same time.
Maybe football supporters aren't buying paintings as well, but maybe they are.
I think we should have something sophisticated as BNL, but that shouldn't be only the thing, and we should be very broad about thinking art for soccer games. Yeah. And that's what I'm going to try to do.
One of the big Brazilian exports, presumably. I was in Rio and São Paulo a couple of months ago doing a story on Globo and Record TV, everything from the news channels to the telenovelas, which are huge exports. Presumably, as culture minister, exporting a lot of Brazilian culture is a soft power thing as well. It's an important thing rather than always having people spending their dollars and pounds and euros in Brazil. You want to be having people buying Brazilian art and importing Brazilian TV shows.
It's very important and very complicated in a way. But I have been recently in Portugal. And people in Portugal, about 15 years ago, they would understand our Portuguese. But they would have to pay lots of attention and have a kind of difficult to understand us. And now they understand very easily Portuguese that we Brazilians speak. It's the same language, but the music and accent are very different. So it makes very difficult for us Brazilians to understand them. We have to pay attention to understand. But we do, but we have to pay attention. It's a little bit more difficult than Americans and British people understand each other. But the impact of novels in Brazil, in Portugal, I was astonished. Because besides understanding, they use words that were not in the vocabulary of the Portuguese people, and they become everyday words. So that was a big, big impact. At the same time, novels, they are not exactly what we are.
And the telenovelas, the Oscar nominations, these are the things that are sort of important. These are the things that are great to export and very important to export as well, I suppose, not in terms of money, but in terms of cultural reputation is an important thing, right?
We are going to put a lot of resource in filmmaking right now. That was a presidential decision. So we are putting 700 million reais into film production in our Ancine, that's the state enterprise that runs filmmaking. And for co-production and infrastructure in production, film production, because we really think we have so many talents that do you want to have an industry?
And just finally, I wanted to ask you how easy or how difficult it is to try and organize the culture of such a huge country around things like the World Cup and the Olympics, but how easy it is, whether it starts off very, very local, or whether as the Minister for Culture you can sort of be in charge of everything like that.
I have been minister for 2 months with thousands of very hard decisions at the parliament first, with laws that are being created, and lots of institutions, museums, and many, many things. It's a huge ministry. It has 3,000 people and very diverse. And the work with culture is not like building bridges. It's very different people and very stimulating, actually, but very different. And I think, as Mrs. McKenzie was telling me, we should have started 2 years ago. But as always, Brazil does things very quick. We are champions on doing that. So I hope that I will be able to succeed like the others before me. And people are very willing to cooperate. People are very excited with the World Cup. And I think we'll do very well.
That was Brazilian Culture Minister Marta Suplicy talking to me there at the Brazilian Embassy in London. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. It's Monocle 24. Next, we'll be taking a trip around Dickens' London. Plenty to look forward to.
Revolutions are fertile conditions for filmmakers, so Monocle took a front row seat at the Doha Tribeca Film Festival to witness the cinema of change emerging in the Arab region.
Like anywhere, when there's social change, people want to raise their voices and want to share what they've been through or what they've experienced. And what I like, it's they do it in a very intimate way. And that's what we want to acknowledge as well, because I think it's stronger and smarter on the long run.
Spotlight on celluloid dreams in the Arab world, premiering on Monocle.com.
Welcome back, dear pals. The bicentenary of the birth of the author Charles Dickens suffered the misfortune of happening right at the start of 2012. Perhaps Mrs. Dickens Sr. should have timed the delivery of her son a little more skillfully, because the Olympics and Jubilee not only contributed to the placing of the UK at the top of Monocle's annual soft power survey, but they also overshadowed the anniversary of one of London's most enduring exports. Emma Nelson examines how a writer who was paid by the word seems to have nailed our concept of Christmas.
Hold your noise! Hold your noise! You little devil, I'll cut your throat! Tell us your name, quick!
Pip!
Once more, give it mouth!
Pip!
The orphan Pip dangled and threatened by the escaped convict Magwitch. This is Charles Dickens' Great Expectations getting the Hollywood treatment.
I stole her heart away and put ice in its place.
Dickens has become a global brand of sorts. Thousands of adaptations, including perhaps the ultimate entry into the popular cultural canon, a Muppet movie. There are seminars in India, conventions in Peru. And if you find yourself at a loose end in the English county of Kent, go for a spin on a Victorian-themed ice rink and then hear Lionel Richie perform at Dickens World in Chatham. Some argue we've forgotten the books, so here's a quick reminder. The original description of Scrooge from A Christmas Carol.
Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, covetous old sinner. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire. Secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster.
Dickens' novels, often published in serial form, created one of the world's first literary celebrities. At the heart of his work is London. Scrooge, for example, was written in the wake of the 1834 Poor Law, which took benefits away, and responding to a theory that as the capital's population swelled, the death of a few was a simple rebalancing. I'm standing in a street of townhouses in Bloomsbury. Behind the Georgian facades, many of these homes are now barristers' chambers, because this is the edge of London's legal district, the Inns of Court. It's also the site of Dickens' only remaining home in the capital. The home has just reopened after a major renovation, and it combines the late Georgian and early Victorian with some rather modern touches.
Mm-hmm.
Inside, a party of faithful fans follows a tour.
This is Dickens's dining room. It's a room where Dickens would have hosted many of his friends in the 2.5 years that he lived at Doughty Street.
Dickens' library is a dark and cosy place. It's lined, as one would expect, with hundreds of books. But visitors are stopped in their tracks by his desk. Unsurprising, really, given that Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby were probably written on it. It's been a tough job to renovate, as Joanne Hatwell, the architect, explains.
It got scarier as it went on, to be honest. It varied from room to room, but quite often there was damp. I mean, I think in the corner of this room there was a part of a tree growing from next door, which had to all be removed. Part of the listing means that we have to use historic materials. So, yeah, if it was lath and plaster, we would be patch repairing with lath and plaster.
The result is a place which not only shows off Dickens' personal tastes, but is also a vivid slice of London life. Here's the museum's curator, Fiona Jenkins.
A house is an embodiment of a person. The idea behind the schemes that we've got here is to display everything, as much as possible, just how Dickens would have walked out of the building. So in the hallway, for example, we've got a stand with all his little objects on. So his snuff box, a theatre token, his letter wallet, his Gladstone bag. We've designed the display case to try and look like a hall stand. So it looks as if Dickens has either just come in and is going up the stairs, or, you know, or perhaps has just left the building, you know, not needing those things. I mean, Dickens is very much a London writer. He describes in his works with so much detail characters and places that are in London and are still here today. And I think the beauty and the appeal to the readers is they can not only imagine these places, but quite often they can actually go and visit them too.
The Dickens fan does seem to like a good tour, so I joined a group of about 20 of them who struck out from Doughty Street into a suitably perishing December afternoon to discover their hero's city. Our guide, Mark, led us through the historic Inns of Court. We stopped in squares and scuttled down alleyways, while clerks peered down from chambers' windows, watching our enthralled little band.
So it's the scene of a romance in Martin Chuzzlewit, that fountain, and Garden Court over there, Pip's living there, when Magwitch turns up on a stormy night and presents himself as true benefactor. That's over there. So Great Expectations very much takes place around here.
None of the group are from London. Voices can be heard from New Jersey, Toronto, and this lady from San Francisco, who shows that the Dickens fan base can be as adoring as a teenager for a boy band.
I came on the tour and I'm spending my whole days that I'm here celebrating Dickens' birthday.
You've come specially for Dickens' 200th anniversary?
Yes, I did. You know, in San Francisco, they have something called the Dickens Christmas Fair. And they have a huge warehouse that they turn into all sorts of delightful Victorian and revelry with lots of small little vignettes of different Dickinsonian scripts being portrayed. This Dickens Christmas Fair I was just mentioning was the blind date that my husband and I were lined up that he took me on. And that was our first date. And by the second date, he decided he wanted to marry me.
It's not just London, but Christmas, where Dickens' influence cannot be underestimated, as our guide Mark explained.
We actually banned Christmas in the 1600s. I don't know if you know that. We banned it for 10 or 11 years, Cromwell. But since that time of the banishment of Christmas, it never quite revived. It never quite came back in its same level of vibrancy. Then into the 1800s, you start getting this nostalgia for the old Christmas, because everyone's moving into the cities, Industrial Revolution, everyone's getting a little bit wistful for the old traditions. And it's Dickens, really. If you imagine Christmas being like a fire in the grate, it was certainly dwindling, it was just the smouldering embers, really. Dickens is the one who comes with a Christmas carol. He revives it as a wonderful, glorious celebration, a great revelry, a party, but around a man's redemption.
I don't know what to do, cried Scrooge, laughing and crying in the same breath. I'm as light as a feather. I'm as happy as an angel. I'm as merry as a schoolboy. I'm as giddy as a drunken man. A Merry Christmas to everybody.
Turn into the right-hand bar.
The Christmas cheer continues with a winter warmer at Ye Olde Cheshire Cheese, a tavern off Fleet Street and one of Dickens' favourite watering holes, although the choice of tipple for some was far from Dickensian.
Doris, could you get me a rum and soda, please?
It's among the wood panels and sawdust that Mark explained to me what he thinks is Dickens' appeal.
Dickens is considered the first cinematic writer in the sense he's very visual, and so he lends himself easily to screenplay. And so because of the adaptations, I think people have... It adds another gloss to Dickens. Sometimes I've said, so who's read the story? And often it's a case of, well, I've seen The Muppets Christmas Carol.
Back in the cold, the tour departs for St Paul's. There's suddenly a spontaneous outburst of singing. It could be Dickens, it could be the rum and soda. But appropriately, it's a Christmas carol.
Tidings of comfort and joy, comfort and joy. Oh, tidings of comfort and joy.
For Monocle, in Dickens, London, I'm Emma Nelson.
There's always one.
This is Culture on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we'll get some more intriguing Turkish jazz from İlhan Ersahin. We'll fly to San Francisco to hear about the anniversary production from Dance King Alonzo King. And we'll meet the curator of the Drake Hotel in Toronto. After all, there is such a thing. So to kick things off, here's some more of İlhan Ersahin's Midori House session. This is Night Ride. That was Night Ride, performed for you live by İlhan Ersahin. And after that session, İlhan had a quick chat with Monocle's Tom Hall.
I was born in Sweden. My mother's Swedish, my father's Turkish. And I started in Sweden actually playing all kinds of music. When I grew up, it was more ska and punk those days. And then I started playing saxophone, so then my search for saxophone started. So I got into jazz through my instrument, actually, not through my family or anything. And then I always wanted to go to New York, because I've always been, since I was 14 years old, New York was ringing, buzzing in my head. And I went to New York, and I'm still there. I've been there 22 years. And I guess the thing with Istanbul started a little bit to find a little bit my roots, who I am, because my name is Turkish, but I'm born Swedish, and I grew up speaking Swedish. But then I started going to Istanbul, and I started finding a scene there. I started playing there 15 years ago. And I started bringing a lot of people from New York. And in late 90s, when it was still new there with having DJs and rappers and band, and so I started bringing all kinds of different kind of... So I kind of got involved in Istanbul scene. And since then, I've been going back and forth.
You're quite unique as a musician in that you not only create free creative albums, but you're also a businessman too, because you own a club in New York that's New Blue. And also in Istanbul now, and also a record label of the same name. Have you found that being a businessman in that way has been essential to making a living out of your music?
I think it's a like indie time, you know, to do your own thing. And I felt a little bit when I started the club 10 years ago in New York. First, like I felt like my music and my friends' music needed a home, since it was not traditional jazz, it was not fusion, it was not ethnic, it was not rock, it was not dance, it was not electro. Our music is kind of a new blues, really everything mixed together. That's why I call it also New Blue, to have its own name. It just seemed like a natural thing to do my own thing somehow. But my own thing means not just me, but also the friends and musicians that are surrounding me. So I don't know, it just kind of, it's a journey I started without kind of long-term planning, but then it became a serious club, and then I opened this club in Istanbul a month and a half ago, and I'm doing also jazz festivals in Istanbul and New York and also in Brazil, which I have a strong root in.
Yeah, and the band you have with you today, I mean, there's so many different sounds in that band. There's only four of you, but there's the traditional kind of jazz sound, then also what I assume is a Turkish kind of rhythm section.
Yeah,
you're kind of a global player. I mean, do you assemble your band in Turkey, or do you have another band in New York? How does that work?
I took this kind of different route as a musician. I don't have one band. I have actually seven projects. I call them projects, and it came up a little bit because I listen to a lot of music. I listen to a lot of different music. And I play also keyboards. So to me, instead of having one band doing like different sound or something, I have different projects doing different things. So this band is Istanbul Sessions. We're doing this thing. And then in New York, I have a band called Wax Poetic, which is more vocal based. And that band is more about songs. It's totally different. So I play more keyboards in that band. And in New York, I have another band called Love Trio, which is more almost like clubby, dancey kind of a thing. So for me, it's more about kind of I choose the way to do more project than having just like one band and just going for one thing.
Ilhan Erşehan, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. The album is called Istanbul Sessions. And that's out now.
It's out in the United States. It's going to come out in Europe in March.
Okay.
And then the other record I gave to you is Wax Poetic. That one is actually more out. You know, these days...
You can never tell these days, can you?
They don't come out global anymore. So yeah. They come out first in France and 3 months later in Germany. But you can check out nublu.net, nublu.net for information, or search iTunes or Monocle Radio.
That was Ilhan Erşehan talking to Tom Hall there. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. In San Francisco, the famed choreographer Alonzo King is celebrating the 30th anniversary of the founding of his dance company with a series of special performances. King is a unique figure in the American dance world, known for his unusual collaborations with pygmies and Shaolin monks, and for ballets that are said to appeal to audiences that don't really like ballets. Monocle correspondent Alistair G met with longtime Bay Area dance critic Rita Felciano to find out more.
Hello, Alistair.
Hi, Rita.
It's good to see you.
So Rita, who is Alonzo King?
It used to be said that Alonzo King was somebody who will attract audiences that hate ballet, because it has the elegance, it has the strength, it has the lines, but it doesn't have the conventional use of an existing language. It's completely his own. In a way, he is like a modern choreographer. He creates his own language with every ballet that he makes, and that is more in the modern dance tradition. Here he has become, you know, very, very popular. But I remember him when he started out. I mean, there were some dancers who I couldn't quite see what he had seen in them, and 5 years later, they were absolutely phenomenal. I also remember him creating a duet with a man who was like one head shorter than his woman partner. And everybody said, you can't do that. The man has to be taller. And then Alonzo said, why do you always have to think when you see a duet that's a romantic relationship? It could be two different, it could be a mother-child relationship, it could be friends relationship. So he breaks down stereotypical, you know, perceptions of what ballet can be.
Alonso himself is black. He has a very, very diverse cast of dancers. When he emerged onto the scene in the 1970s, was he seen in some regard as breaking down barriers in traditional dance?
You know, I didn't see him at that time, so I really don't know. He has always had a mixed company. Sometimes there have been more black dancers, sometimes more Caucasians. Obviously, because the simple fact that he is African-American makes a statement in itself, but he never has considered himself primarily a black choreographer. He looks for dancers who have very good training as ballet dancers, but who want more than the traditional ballet. Yeah, he's a pioneer that way, but I don't think he thinks of himself that way at all.
Was his own training in classical dance?
Yeah, he was trained in classical dance, absolutely. Yeah, it's called, his company is called Lines Ballet. It is a ballet company, but he does not always use, for instance, point shoes. And he does not use, as I told you, the academic vocabulary, but it's the principles of ballet, which is like a geometric language that inform what he does. I know this is very abstract, but that's the way he is. That's the way he is. And one of the things which is really also interesting about him, while he works a lot with his own dancers, he has also worked with the Baka people from, you know, that called the Pygmies. He has brought with them and worked from their culture, from their movement, with his own dancers. He has the same thing done with the Shaolin warriors, or the Tibetan monks, has used them that way. This kind of collaboration. He has also choreographed for the Ballet de Monaco. That's a strict ballet company. And in next February, he's doing something with Hubbard Street Company in Chicago, which is a strictly modern dance company. So what he does is has a very broad range. And still, with whoever he works and choreographs, it always has that very specific look with a lot of the body basically divided into lines, people interacting with each other, and a lot of unexpected moments.
I love the idea of him working with the Shaolin monks, of working with the Pygmy tribe, but is this a gimmick or does it work?
It's not a gimmick. It's something that he very deeply believes in. He's very much a man of the world. In terms of I think the pieces work, but maybe not in a traditional sense. Because the two groups of dancers, they're very respectful of each other and they might interact, but they also have their own independent existence on stage, and you can see that. I mean, that's the idea, this kind of coexistence of different cultures in one moment. He does similar things with music. I mean, he works with Western classical music, he works with Tibetan chant, he works with Russian chant, he has worked with jazz musicians. It's just an extremely broad approach to ballet.
Does he have international stature?
His company travels more than many other companies in this country. And they primarily travel in Europe. They have a big following in Eastern Europe, in Germany, on the continent. They have been to Asia, they're all over. His ballets are in Swedish companies, French companies. So he travels more abroad, I think, than he travels in the United States. And if you want to know why, I'm not sure, but I think in the United States, we have a very specific, very strong ballet tradition, which goes back to Balanchine and Jerome Robbins and people like that. And maybe we are not quite open enough to accept what he does as easily as Europeans who don't have that kind of tradition. I don't know.
In the latest piece that I saw, Constellations, there isn't really a narrative per se. What should I and other audiences be looking for in his dances if not a story?
I think you just go in there without any preconceptions of what ballet is and what dance is, and you know you'll have a good time watching. I can guarantee that. That's for sure. There is nothing to figure out. I think if you're open with your eyes and your ears, the dancers will communicate to you.
That was critic Rita Falciano talking there to Alistair G. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to Toronto in a sec.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Culture on Monocle 24. We're now, we're off to Canada. The Drake is a boutique hotel in Toronto, located in the heart of the local art scene. The hotel has its own permanent collection and a myriad of visiting artworks on display, most of them by Canadian artists. The hotel's curator, Mia Nielsen, gave Monocle's associate editor, Nelly Gocheva, an insightful tour through the hotel's rooms and hallways to learn about Toronto's art scene and the Drake's future cultural plans.
You know, the idea of the Drake really is to take all of life's best things and do them all at once. And so we want to eat great food, we want to dance all night, we want to see great music and surprises and be surrounded by great art and great culture and stimulate minds and hearts.
You have a permanent collection and you also have like guest pieces and stuff, which changes once a month or twice a month. But how do you make your selection?
We do 5 exhibitions a year, so they change every few months. And with the exhibitions, generally what happens, my personal process, is that I go to a lot of exhibitions, I do a lot of research, I see all kinds of things. And I'm interested in finding what I think of as storylines or themes that cross cultures in contemporary art. So an idea that could, themes where, you know, artists from all over the world are picking them up.
It's great that you have a lot of international artists, but what is really impressive, I think, is that you actually have a lot of local and national Canadian artists. How do you make your selection? Are you trying to kind of support mostly Canadian art, or is it just like whatever you like or country-wise?
No, it's definitely a balance. It's important to show local and national artists because there's so many great things going on. But I think to understand visually and culturally what's happening here, we need to have a greater dialogue with other countries and other cultures. You know, what I'm looking for is an installation, an artwork, a film, an experience that has some kind of a surprise, that makes a comment on where we are right now, whether it's this incredible installation we did with Peaches for the film festival, these beautiful films. She did a building-wide performance. It was an incredible, an incredible cultural moment. So I'm interested in supporting these kinds of things, as well as, Storm Tharp's painting that has this beautiful balance of abstraction and realism, yet it's this casual representation of a friend. Canadian art is thriving in so many exciting ways in so many places. The O Canada show at Mass MoCA, which is still on right now in upstate New York, in Massachusetts. Sorry, Mass MoCA, is a wonderful cross section of so many exciting practices. We have Kent Monkman, who's rethinking art history and canonical paintings. We have Dean Baldwin's super playful installation. We have Mafonwe McLeod's beautiful collages. There's so many things going on, and these are all very different practices. Daniel Barrow, whose animations and performances are so inspiring. He did a beautiful shadow play with us for Nuit Blanche this year. And of course, I'm very excited about Sherry Boyle representing Canada at the Venice Biennale in June. And in some ways, I hate to name names because by naming, you know, one person, I'm not naming, you know, five others who are doing really exciting work. But there's so many different voices in Canada, and you know, in every medium, there's someone who's, yeah, really breaking barriers.
Do you think that for the artists to be exhibited at places like the Drake, do you think that this is beneficial for them?
Oh, for sure. Part of what's so exciting for me as a curator is the incredibly diverse audience we have. We have so many people. You can hear upstairs, there are people moving chairs for brunch over our heads. You know, we have packed houses for, you know, like rock and roll shows late at night. And, you know, we have young families in for brunch. So it's exciting for artists to have their work seen by so many people from so many backgrounds. Lots of connections can be made because of that. So all kinds of things happen, from, you know, connections from a visiting curator who sees something that, you know, he or she gets excited about, to a traveler who just falls in love with a work in the lobby and, you know, buys it on the spot. So, yeah, so many stories.
That was Maya Nielsen, curator at the Drake Hotel in Toronto, with Monocle's associate editor Nelly Gacheva. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week will be our Christmas special. We'll talk comedy, thespians, festive music and radio plays, of course. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. The show was produced by the dreamiest of all dream teams, Katie Bilbao and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from his Midori House session and from the album named Istanbul Sessions is İlhan Ersehin. Thanks for tuning in.